Welcome to Office Hours, where we follow up on the most frequently asked questions from Policy Ed videos. I'm Tom Church, a policy fellow at the Hoover Institution, and today I'm talking to Terry Anderson about the questions we received in his videos about renewing indigenous economies. Terry's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and leads its Renewing Indigenous Economies project. Terry, your videos had thousands of comments and questions, and one of the most popular ones we received was this. In what ways were early indigenous economies like our modern free market economies? Is it possible to draw parallels between groups that lived hundreds of years apart?
Early indigenous economies were like modern free market economies in many ways. First, trade was something that Indians fully understood. The idea that you could trade your beads for somebody else's buffalo or your fish for some dried berries. A classic example of trade routes was the pipestone that we think of in the peace pipes. This came from one place only in Minnesota, Pipestone, Minnesota, and that was traded all across the continent. My favorite trade story that illustrates just how extensive the trade was is that Lewis and Clark lived in the Mandan villages in their first winter crossing to the Pacific, and they traded axes which had a symbol of the Lewis and Clark expedition stamped in them. They traded those for horses and blankets and so on. Once they reached the western slope of the mountains, the drainages into the Pacific, and came to the Nez Perce villages, one of the trade axes was already there. That just shows that these were trading one after another, and they were always, well, I like your peace pipe better than my trade axe, or I like your horse better than your peace pipe. And that was just a classic example of how the indigenous economies use trade in the same way that we think of it today in a global market economy.
Would you say that modern ideas of property rights are in line with Native beliefs about land ownership?
Modern ideas of property rights are not like Indian beliefs in property rights in some ways. For example, Indians didn't survey land and have rectangular grids all over their territories. Of course, they didn't have deeds in the courthouse, which we think of as part of our property rights. But to the extent that property rights simply mean that somebody or some group has the right to exclude others, Indians clearly had a system of property rights or a system at least of claims on resources. A favorite example of mine are the clam gardens in the Pacific Northwest. Clam gardens were beaches that were cleared of big rocks where sand was moved in. Seed, oysters, and clams were moved in. And as a result, they increased the production. Well, it wasn't the case that just anyone could come and use that garden. It belonged to a certain family or group, a clan, and they reaped the benefits of having property rights to those resources. Similarly, and this is really evident today as we discuss the wildfires that have ravaged the West and especially California, Indians burned territories to increase the forage for the wildlife that they wanted to harvest. And I emphasize the word territories because they burned territories that belonged to that tribe. And another tribe couldn't come in and say, oh, you've increased the forage and now you have more buffalo, so we're going to hunt here. No, that was a property right, a claim to resources that's very much like we would think of a state or a county, a city, or my land.
Turning to modern day issues, Terry, what's standing in the way of Native Americans from starting businesses and generally improving their lives?
Returning to the question of property rights in indigenous economies and certainly in modern indigenous economies, property rights are something that tribes really don't have. Many American Indians and tribal leaders say, our land is owned by the federal government. And that is because that land, the tribal land, a lot of the Indian lands, individual tribal members' lands, is held in trust. Think of it this way. You end up with a trust fund that your parents give you. You can't just take that trust fund and use it because there are trustees who tell you what to do. Indian land is held in trust by the federal government, using the words from the laws that do this, because Indians need to be deemed competent and capable, those are the words in the law, before they can hold property rights to their land. And so this idea of trusteeship means that tribes or individual Indians don't have assets that they can take to the bank. Outside of reservations, people own a house, and that's part of their collateral that they may use on a loan to start a new business. They have an entrepreneurial idea. They go to the bank and say, I have $50,000 in equity or $500,000 in equity. Indians have no equity because they can't use their land as collateral. And to make that worse, because the jurisdictions are so unclear, the tribes and individual Indians have a hard time getting money, borrowing money from our typical financial institutions, because those institutions can't easily collect on their loans if something happens. So if you drive through a reservation, you don't see very many modern, well-built, nice houses. What you will see are mobile homes, because those can be confiscated, taken back by the person who loans the money to buy that. So it's mostly the lack of ownership, the trusteeship, this notion that the federal government dictates their lives, that holds Indians in colonial bondage.
Why is it important to Native peoples that they stay on their reservation lands?
More than any other minority, Native Americans stay on the reservations with their families, clans, and tribes, because there is a long history of cultural connections that are part of life. And those are steeped in traditional ceremonies, steeped in traditional interaction between tribal members and clans. And that's very important to Native Americans. That said, Native Americans who do move off reservations do better. If you go to a university and get an education, a way to invest in your human capital, as we economists call it, you take that human capital and try to capitalize on it by taking a job on a reservation, because there are no jobs. On the reservation, the federal government, because of trusteeship and other laws, dictates what Indians can and cannot do. The lack of outside capital investment means there are no jobs. You stay on the reservation even though you get poor health care, you get poor education, you get poor infrastructure, you still get it. And so many people have a hard time deciding to leave that kind of an environment, socialistic, if you will, as many Native Americans call it, that socialistic environment, to go out into the world where you have to earn a living. So there is this really wonderful connection of families and clans to the tribal traditions that keeps them together. I've gone to powwows, for example, with the Crow tribe, and they're just a fantastic, almost spine-chilling example of these connections. But those connections keep people on reservations where there are no jobs and there is poverty, and there's little hope of getting out of that poverty while staying on the reservation.
What would you say are some policies that could be enacted to restore tribal sovereignty?
Since the early 20th century, tribes have been held in colonial bondage by trusteeship. And we've discussed that already. That trusteeship is in place because the law says Indians are not capable and competent. So the first policy change would be to eliminate this notion of incompetency and incapability. Tribes and individuals are surely both competent and capable. Getting rid of the law that dictates that, and hence releasing tribes and individual Indians from the bondage of trusteeship, would be a first policy change I would recommend. Secondly, tribes need to be given legal jurisdiction over their lands. That's part of getting them out of trusteeship means. But it also means giving tribes the power to tax lands inside the reservation. Of course, states would rather they tax it, and therein lies a policy hurdle. But tribes, if they can tax their own lands, they have the ability to produce the kinds of public goods, education, roads, healthcare, that they can only produce now with grants from the federal government. So sovereignty is the first step towards a foundation for a real tribal government. Once that's tribal, then tribes have the ability to really be sovereign nations as we assert they are and as they would like to be. But even that sovereignty begins at the individual level. My good Crow Indian friend, Bill Yellowtail, who's done a video for this series, emphasizes that individual sovereignty is the building block for tribal sovereignty. Once individuals have the understand that they have individual rights, individual liberty, they can build then to a tribe that has the kinds of rule of law, the kinds of sovereignty to assert jurisdiction that can, I think, move tribes on. So policy changes need to be release tribes from trusteeship, give them jurisdiction over the resources on their land, and then allow them to really be sovereign nations that other governmental entities have to reckon with.
This last one's a two-parter. Are there examples of tribes that have recovered their sovereignty? And what's keeping other tribes from doing the same thing?
Although Native Americans remain the poorest of poor minorities, there are tribes that are beginning to rise up and use their resources to become successful entrepreneurial organizations. The Winnebago tribe in Nebraska, for example, has used revenues from gaming, they have jurisdiction over gaming, to reinvest in other kinds of opportunities that generate revenue for the tribe. Their tribal corporation, Ho-Chunk Inc., takes the revenue from gaming, invests in many other kinds of ventures that generate revenues for the tribe. The tribe then reinvests those in infrastructure, roads, houses, education, and healthcare. The Winnebago are just a wonderful example of a tribe that's doing it by itself. Another one comes from Southern Utah, the Southern Ute. It's a tribe that has extensive oil and gas resources. A law allowed them to have jurisdiction over those resources. And as a result, they have created a company that invests all over the country. They own buildings in Houston. They have oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico. And once again, they produce their own education, their own healthcare. They do it themselves. What is unfortunate is that many tribes don't have a gaming operation that's close to a large population, or they don't have natural resources like oil and gas. And so the question is, can they do anything? Yes. If they have small, they can use that land to generate revenues to do other things. Here in the United States and Louisiana, the Coushatta tribe started with 15 acres when they were re-recognized in 1974 by the federal government. Those 15 acres are held in trust. But they have roughly 6,000 acres in private land that they have purchased through gaming revenues again. And those are crawfish farms, are soybean farms, are rice farms, and they are generating a lot of money. They are the third largest employer in Louisiana. Another example of a tribe doing well that started with nothing, but built on entrepreneurship and a solid rule of law created by the tribe that allows investment to occur in and around their reservation.
Thank you, Terry. That's it for now. If you have more questions for our scholars, make sure to leave them in the comments below.